This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
According to author John Keel, in 1965, there was a group of alien contactees in Mexico that claimed that they were taken to a place the alien beings referred to as Ganymede. 3 years later, in 1968, an even larger group of people from South America claimed to have been contacted by beings who said they came from a place that they also called Ganymede. The strangest of these cases were not only that they both had people not only seeing UFOs, but they were claiming to have been contacted and transported to faraway places in space to visit another world called Ganymede. And they were countries away from each other and 3 years apart in the 1960s. And if you dive a little bit into the technology that was available in the late 60s, not only in Mexico and South America, but honestly the whole world, it would prove to be damn near impossible for these people to be in contact with each other to share their stories. In fact, these people's encounters wouldn't have even been known by Keel if it weren't for his background in journalism. And people wouldn't believe Keel if it weren't for his various ways of documenting and recording firsthand stories from the contactees themselves. But why were people countries away from each other sharing experiences about Jupiter's moon? The fact is, they weren't referring to Jupiter's moon. And that's not where the strangeness ends. Not by a long shot. Welcome back to Infinite Rabbit Hole. Welcome back to the Infinite Rabbit Hole, everybody. I'm your host, Jeremy, and today I'm finally over whatever I had, whatever it was that I had, and I finally got my voice back. For those of you that are on the Facebook or follow the Instagram, you guys got a video from me explaining why this episode came out so late, and thanking you once again for the 100,000 listens or plays or downloads or streams or whatever you want to call it that the Infinite Rabbit Hole has received from you over the last 3.5 years. Thank you. Thank you, travelers. I can't explain this enough. This is such a big thing for us. We have a lot of stuff in the horizon. Listen to the end of the episode for some peeks into what's in the future of the Infinite Rabbit Hole. With that being said, today we're covering Injured Cold again. We're remastering the series that really, I think, honestly, propelled the Infinite Rabbit Hole into the ears of a lot of people around the world. I was not expecting the Injured Cold series to get that big. It's absolutely huge, absolutely humongous. And the first person I have to thank for that is Ashers. Ashers from the On Wednesdays We Talk Weird podcast, who actually I'm co-hosting a show under that RS feed called Beasts and Beyond, which actually my first episode with her came out February 26th. So go check that out. We did that on the Loveland Frogman. Now, of course, not putting the Infinite Rabbit Hole aside, that is an additional project that I'm doing, and I'm very, very excited to do that because I get to do something a little bit different. Before we start, I do want to say that if you guys have been listening to the Infinite Rabbit Hole for a while, you'll know that we ended up doing a part 5 to the Injured Cold series. It was an interview with Tanya Derenberger, the daughter of Woody Derenberger, who had incredible insight into this amazing story. Unfortunately, Tanya passed away last year, May 19th, 2023, from her battle with multiple sclerosis. I can't even begin to say enough about her. With me being the curious person that I am, especially around this topic of injured cold, I would send her messages all the time, asking her questions about injured and Connard and Connor, his two sons that she kept in contact with. You know, she was always willing to answer. And she became a good friend of mine. She became a fan of the Infinite Rabbit Hole, where she would send me a message or a text commenting on an episode that we did prior. And a couple of times, she actually made a connection with some of the older series before that to the Injured Cold stories. And there were connections that I never could imagine. But once she said it, it was like a light clicked on. And I was like, oh, man, wow, I can't believe I missed that. I don't want to keep you guys too much. I just want to say, once again, thank you so much for the 100K. Really, really, really appreciate it. I re-recorded all of this. Took me 2 hours. And then after editing down, hopefully I can get it to around that two-hour mark. Sorry for how long it is for those that don't like the really long episodes, but this is a special. So enjoy. Here I am rambling. So without further ado, travelers, here is Injured Cold Remastered. I'll see you on the other side. Chapter 1. Woody. First Contact. On the night of November 2nd, 1966, Woodrow, aka Woody, was driving down Interstate 77 from Marietta, Ohio to his home in Mineral Wells, West Virginia. Now, Woody Derenberger was an appliance salesman who had just started his career in the field after going on strike the same year at his previous career working for the Union Carbide. That's a chemical and polymer plant that employed a lot of people in the area, by the way. As he was approaching the intersection of I-77 and Route 47, Woody noticed a set of headlights in his rearview mirrors blinking off and on. This signal was often used back then for wanting to pass someone. The car passed Woody, and soon after, he noticed that another car was coming up fairly quickly with their high beams on. As what Woody refers to as, quote-unquote, the ship, pulled up beside his car, he noticed that it was no vehicle he had ever seen before. The lightless ship pulled in front of Woody's truck and turned sideways, blocking all lanes of the highway, and slowly came to a stop. Woody slowed down and pulled over onto the shoulder of the road before stopping his vehicle completely. During the entire time, Woody's truck and all the lights, radio, and gauges worked perfectly fine, and according to Woody, the craft stood 45 to 60 feet away and resembled an old kerosene lamp sitting on its side. The center of the ship was large and tapered off as it extended left and right before it flared back up before the ends. The craft was dark gray, and even though there were absolutely no lights coming from the craft, it did glisten in the rain, and the only sound he heard was a soft and steady flapping. Now, Woody stopped roughly 8 to 10 feet away from the craft with his headlights illuminating its side. Very soon after they had both stopped, a door on the ship had opened and a man exited the craft. After the man was completely out of his ship, it rose into the air about 500 to 100 feet above the location, directly above where it stopped. Woody watched as the man walked directly in front of the headlights of his truck, and by his best guesses, Woody described the man as being just shy of 6 feet tall, around 180 pounds, perfectly tanned skin, and black slicked back hair. There was absolutely nothing off about this man. As the man stood in the light casted by the truck's headlights, Woody began hearing a voice in his head, asking him to please roll down the window. Woody leaned across the front seat of the truck and rolled down the passenger side window for the man. But instead of walking to the passenger side, the man walked over to Woody's side and looked at Woody through the driver's side window and began mind-speaking to him, asking him, telling him to not be afraid, followed up by asking what his name was. Woody became very scared of the situation that he found himself in and discovered that it was hard to speak to the man. Then, as if the man could read his mind, his voice returned to Woody's head stating that he could answer by thinking or by speaking and that either way was just fine. And without Woody saying a word, the man replied, quote, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Derenberger. My name is Cold." Immediately after introducing himself, Cold asked Woody if he worked for a living. Woody responded by explaining that he was a salesman, and Cold responded by telling him that he himself was what they called a searcher, followed directly with telling Woody that, quote, he shouldn't be frightened, and that he wished him no harm and only happiness. Now, Cold was sporting a large grin and stood with his arms crossed and his hands under his armpits. He continued the conversation by asking what the lights were in the distance, and Mr. Derenberger responded by telling him that the lights were the city of Parkersburg. Cold followed up by asking Woody if that was a place where most people lived, and Woody responded by explaining that some people surely did live there, but the most people lived in the surrounding areas and that the city was mostly for business and entertainment. Cold explained that where he is from, areas like that are called gatherings. The conversation then took a slight different tone. Cold told Woody to look at him and stated, quote, I am the same as you are. I sleep and breathe and bleed, just as you do. Have no fear. We mean you no harm. Now, side note, this whole conversation was being done non-verbally, and Woody stated that he could hear every word clearly as if he was being spoken to. Cold continued by asking Mr. Derenberger why he was so frightened, and quote, my country is not nearly as powerful as yours. Cold ended the conversation by telling him to report his experience to the officials and that he would be back at a later date to confirm his story. Without any sign from Cold, the craft lowered down and the door opened back up, and Woody was able to see another man inside the craft. The man closed the door after Cold had entered and slowly began to rise up off the ground, and by the time it was above the trees, Woody had taken off as quickly as he could. The police. Woody arrived home and asked his wife, Catherine, to come into the kitchen to talk with him. When she got to the kitchen, she saw that her husband was very distraught and asked him if he had been in an accident that killed someone. Woody assured that that was not the case and began telling her what he had just witnessed. She was concerned about the incident and recommended that Woody call the police. When Woody was on the phone with the police station, he became very upset and found it very hard to form the words he wanted to in order to pass on a story. So Catherine took the phone and did her best to retell his story. And when she was done, the officer asked her to hang up the phone, that he would call her back momentarily. Now, they only had to wait about 10 minutes. The officer asked Catherine if Woody was still upset and if he needed to go to the hospital. She replied that he was doing much better and that she didn't think he needed to see a doctor. The officer on the line told her that he wasn't crazy and that he shouldn't feel bad. They received two other calls about similar events that night on the same stretch of road. The news station. The next day, Woody headed to work at around 8 o'clock, where he told his employer about his experience from the night prior. And he didn't believe the story, but we will note this later. At around 10 a.m., a producer from the WTAP-TV station in Parkersburg came into the shop and asked Woody if he would be willing to go public that night. Woody agreed to do it and arrived at the TV station at 2:30 p.m. Waiting for Woody's arrival at the station was a representative from the Parkersburg newspaper, Sergeant Plum from the Parkersburg Police Station, Sergeant Vandevender of the West Virginia State Police, Air Force personnel, and many other people that Woody didn't know. Woody answered their questions until about 6 p.m. and would find out during his interview that many other people had reported something very similar, and most had described the exact same strange craft as Woody did. Now, these other reports were reported to the city and state police as well as many different radio and TV stations. One of these reports came in from a mom and her son and daughter who stopped their car to watch this craft. The police station believes that this encounter happened immediately after Woody's encounter and may have even been the ascent after the incident with Woody and Derenberger that this family was watching. When the craft left the area, it was heading towards Parkersburg. Another man reported an incident where the craft was hovering over his car and shining a blinding white light over his entire vehicle on the same stretch of road. Two truck drivers reported being stopped by a vehicle that they described as being very similar to the one that stopped Woody to author and investigator John Keel. These men did not want publicity and stayed anonymous. We will be talking about this encounter in deeper detail later, but after the interview, Woody headed home and arrived around 6:30 to a crowd of people in his yard. Some he knew, and most he did not. They all wanted to hear Woody's story again, and some even came forward to him about their own encounters with a craft in that area as well. At 2:30 a.m., Woody asked everyone to leave since he had to work the next morning. Woody's second incident. The next day, on the 4th of November, 2 days after his first contact with Mr. Cold, Woody was driving home from Pomeroy, Ohio with a friend. Driving south on Route 7, Woody began to feel a strange feeling in and around his head. He described it as a slight tingling. Later on, the passenger of the vehicle also claims to have a strange feeling come over him as well. Woody claimed to know that Cold was attempting to contact him telepathically, which Woody reluctantly accepted by thinking a thought to Mr. Cold. Cold told Woody that he thought he should slow down and drive safer. His craft was hovering over his vehicle very high and that he was following him. This time, Woody claims that he is much more accepting of the situation and knew that this was sitting better with Cold. Cold continued his conversation with Woody by telling him that he comes from a planet known as Lanulos, get this, near a galaxy called Ganymede. Woody later would feel that this information was intended to be incorrect to keep Cold's planet safe, and Mr. Cold would continue to tell Woody that his planet was bigger than Earth, but it was practically the same. It had mountains, forests, streams, and oceans, and a lot of the same plant and animal life with slight exceptions. He told of his wife, Kimmy, his two sons, and his newborn daughter they named Kimilis after her mother. Their planet only had three seasons, planting, harvesting, and cold, and the life expectancy of the people on their planet was between 125 to 175 Earth years. And just before Mr. Cold warned that he was ready to break contact and to expect a severe shock as the contact was broken, he told Woody that his first name was Indrid. Just after that, their communications to each other were broken, but Woody never received the shock that Cold had warned about. Instead, he had a pain in his temples that quickly spread through his head. The only place Woody initially reported this incident to was directly to NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Area Phenomena in D.C. Fallout from the interview. The amount of attention that Woody and his family received after the televised interview was way more than he had anticipated. He received phone calls from all over the country, letters from all over the world, and people were showing up at his house at night to watch the skies. On most nights, 25 to 30 people would show up, and some of them would even knock on the door to personally ask questions and hear Woody's story. Woody worked mostly in the evening, so often his wife would be left alone with his children while strangers piled up outside and knocked on their door. One night, Woody arrived home late from work and noticed that there was an unusual amount of people parked by his house. He and his wife estimated it at 150 individuals. It became obvious that this was too much when he noticed men in the trees with shotguns. Woody called the police to remove the people from his property, but as soon as the police left, most of them came right back. The effects of all the attention began to find its way into the lives of his children, Charles, age 7, and Tanya, age 3. We'll talk a little bit more about Tanya a little bit later. Charles was being bullied at school, and both children were having a very difficult time falling asleep due to all the noise outside at night. Both children suffered from nightmares on a nightly basis as well, and Woody's sales began to drop drastically. And since he was a traveling salesperson, living off of commissions from his sales, the attention began to affect the Derenbergers financially as well. Nobody was buying from Woody anymore. Everyone was familiar with his story, and most thought he was crazy. Those that did reach out to request a visit from him to discuss the sale of an appliance only did so to talk to him about the UFO and had absolutely no interest in actually buying any. This resulted in his family having to move and sell most of their furniture, and they moved into his wife's family's summer cabin and were able to find peace for about a month. But soon after, the UFO craze found them again. Their new home was set up on the banks of the Kanawha River, and soon after they moved, there was a very large flap of UFO sightings along their section of the river. Someone then found out that the Derenbergers were living there and contacted the local press, and the stories that came out claimed that the large rash of UFO activity was in fact due to Woody and his family's presence and that they were contacting him in private. The crowds began to form on their lawn again, and this forced them to move yet again, this time to the dead center of Vienna, West Virginia, with the idea that hiding in plain sight might be the way to go. The craze followed them yet again when a German TV crew showed up requesting for them to be a part of their documentary that they were planning to film. This was too much for his wife, Catherine, and she left him with their children and moved to Cleveland, Ohio. Woody soon followed them to Cleveland, but it was too late, and they were divorced in 1970. Additional interviews. At the end of December in 1966, Woody was contacted by the former police chief of Parkersburg and current captain of the Cocoa Beach, Florida Police Department, Bruce Parsons. He was also working as a security guard for NASA and was told to reach out and invite Woody and his family to Florida so that Woody can tell his story directly to the head of NASA, a man only introduced to Woody as Charlie. Instead of a pleasant trip to Florida and thrilling tours of the Cape Kennedy base, he was instead interrogated for 5 days by many different people. Afterwards, he was told that there was nothing new in his stories and that everything he told Alanulos, Mr. Cold, and the craft had already been reported numerous times before. Woody then asked why they never came forward with the information. In reply, they said that if they did, there would be mass panic around the world. Quote, many people would commit crimes or even suicide. And a quoted line from the book Visitors from Lanulos by Woodrow Derenberger states that they said, quote, women would commit suicide, throw babies out of windows, jump under trains, and that this kind of panic could sweep the entire world, end quote. Additional interviews and investigations were conducted by SACI, Space Age Communications Incorporated, NICAP, and the Air Force. NICAP even went as far as to hire Dr. Robert A. Jenkins, a local psychiatrist, to administer an EEG test to test for epilepsy, which came back negative with particular terminology, such as, quote, no evidence of epilepsy, normal recording with no indication of, and central nervous system pathology at all, and no evidence of any psychiatric disorders. NICAP dropped even lower by telling Woody to not speak to anybody regarding these events unless there were a representative from NICAP itself. Woody responded by telling them that he will speak to anybody he wants to. In turn, the representative that interviewed Woody returned a report to NICAP claiming that his stories were false and the told events reminded him of a carnival. Indrid visits Woody's home. Woody was still living in Mineral Falls, West Virginia one night when he came home very late from work. He claims that as soon as he opened the door of his car, he heard Indrid tell him to not be frightened and that he and Carl were on his back porch. Woody invited them into his house to get out of the cold, but Indrid refused as he did not wish to wake anybody up. They talked for almost 2 hours on Woody's back porch. They talked about the space programs they had on Lanulos and how they learned and studied how to control gravity and manipulate distance in space. They told Woody of their world and how they never had a war erupt on their planet. They described how everyone saw each other as brothers and sisters and that they worshipped one god in a religion that they only referred to as the Children of God. They believed that there was one god that created all of the worlds. Woody tried to explain that there were many religions on our planet, and how often they were the basis of many wars. Indrid's opinion was that these wars were mostly because people did not have the right tools to properly communicate to one another. He said that many times it is hard to take a thought and put it into words, but with telepathy, their planet has learned to understand someone's thoughts, ideas, and point of views without having to formulate words. Indrid told Woody that his planet's population should learn telepathy, and that everyone has the ability to learn it, as it is very easy to learn with the right teachers. In the beginning. During their conversation on Woody's back porch, Indrid and Carl told him of the beginnings of Lanulos and how it came to be. The legend they told was how a spacecraft that crash-landed on the planet of Lanulos, which they believed was from Earth, by the way. There were males and females on the ship, and there were also families. They worked for many years to fix the craft, and the result was their failure and anger between individuals. So they broke up the group and traveled in different directions. All of the separated people began farming what they could to live. But after years of loneliness, they craved interaction with their long-lost friends. But because they were duly unfamiliar with this planet and its terrain, they were afraid to leave the immediate vicinity of their individual homes. One night, one of the men thought that he could hear another's voice. A voice that was familiar, but one that he hadn't heard in a long time. That voice, he found, was in his mind. The man believed that this was the thoughts of a man that he had come to this planet with. So he focused a very long time and found that he could hear his words as clear as day. During these attempts, the other man began to hear his thoughts and their conversation began on how to find each other. Through their primitive form of telepathy, they discovered each other's locations and met up together. After that, they put their minds together to find the others. And they believed that the reunity of their people was a gift directly from God. And from there on out, they devoted their lives to serving their God, to thank him for this gift. The Lanulos government. Another topic that they discussed that night was the politics of Lanulos. The world was led by what they call the Guiding Council. The Guiding Council is an entity that comprises representatives from each planet in what is called the Intergalactic Circle. These representatives are voted upon by the population of each planet. And the benefits of joining this intergalactic circle is the sharing of technologies, medicine, and engineering, as well as the combined focus of all planets to solve all the individual planets' problems. It is agreed that there is absolutely no use of force on one another in any capacity. And at the end of their conversation, Indrid invited Woody to take a trip on their ship, which at this time, Woody refused. Indrid visits Woody's home again. Woody arrived home at around 11 p.m. two nights after the chat on his back porch. This time, Indrid and his friend Carl Ardo were waiting for his arrival in the front yard and again had another decently long talk. This time, when Woody followed Indrid and Carl back to their ship, Indrid again asked if Woody would like to see the inside of the ship. And this time, Woody went inside and was shown almost the entire ship. On his way out, he saw a panel about as high as his shoulders that was glowing light blue. He reached his hand out to touch it, and the door slammed closed. Woody became terrified that he was trapped in the craft and that they were going to take him away. Indrid replied with a chuckle and a smile after hearing Woody's thoughts and said something along the lines of, "No, we won't leave unless you want to go with us." Woody walked out after reopening the door, and Indrid said that one day, soon, he would be giving another chance to go aboard and go for a ride. Woody's Ride. One night, while Woody was returning home via Route 21 from Ravenswood, West Virginia, he received another telepathic message from Indrid. This time he said that if Woody wanted to go for a ride, now was the time, and to meet him at a place where a new highway was under construction. Once Woody arrived at the location that the ship had landed at, Indrid told him that they would bring him anywhere he wanted to go on Earth. Woody didn't know why he chose it, but he chose the Amazon forest. Sooner rather than later, they were high above the Amazon looking down on the sea of dense forest. The cover on the windows slid up, and they were able to look out and see villages and streets and people walking as they passed over. They did not stay long, and after they were done, instead of traveling back to West Virginia, they traveled directly upward and out of the Earth's atmosphere and quickly towards the moon. Soon it became obvious that they were traveling towards another much larger ship that Indrid called the flagship of Lanulos, but Woody just referred to it as the mothership. As they came into contact with a docking port on the bottom of this big, large ship, a hatch on the top of Indrid's craft opened up, and this is how Woody entered the flagship of Lanulos. Once aboard the mothership, Woody had a chance to meet the commander of the vessel and eat a meal in their cafeteria. They served a substance that reminded him of potatoes and a vegetable that was almost exactly like green beans, and a meat that they referred to as katuma that tasted like white-tailed deer. After the meal, they jumped back into Indrid's craft and took a trip just above the surface of the moon. Here, Woody could see bridges over craters and a tunnel that Indrid said was used as a type of parking garage for other ships. After the moon, the windows closed again, and Indrid said that they would only be closed for a few minutes while they traveled at very high speeds. When the windows opened again, he was told that they were in the atmosphere of what they on Earth called Saturn. The planet was shaped like a giant bowl under all the clouds, and the rim was completely encompassed in ice. But at the bottom of the bowl, there were fields of agriculture. Indrid explained that the planet is not mineable, and any equipment that they use here has to be flown in. After Saturn, they flew Woody directly to Lanulos. As they approached the land on the planet, they slowed significantly until they stalled just high enough off the ground to see everything on the planet up close. They flew through cities, fields, forests, and rivers. The people below waved back to him when he waved out the window. Indrid was proud of this planet and showed Woody many different sights, but explained that he would not be able to leave the craft as he would have to be immunized so that he didn't contract anything from Lanulos and he didn't bring anything here from Earth. Indrid told Woody to not worry and that one day he will be able to land and talk directly to the people of Lanulos. Indrid continued by telling Woody that if he wished, he could relocate his family to this planet, Mars, Venus, or any other planet that he desired where there were already people. The second trip to Lanulos. May 11th, 1967, Woody was on his way to Pomeroy, Ohio for work when he received another message from Indrid asking if he would like to go to Lanulos again. The problem this time was that the meetup place was not safe enough to leave his truck, so Indrid's friends Clennell and Elvain Cletaw, Clennell being from the planet Cernibus, devised a plan for Clennell to drive Woody's truck to Pomeroy and parked somewhere non-suspicious while being followed by Alvain in a blue Volkswagen, who would drive Clennell back to the ship where they and the car would be taken on board. This time, when Woody entered the ship, he met a few more of Indrid's people, his wife Kimmy, two members of the ship's crew, Tony and Daryl, and of course, Indrid's second-in-command, Carl Ardo, was also there. In Woody's best estimate, the trip to Lanulos took roughly 30 minutes this time. As they drew closer to Lanulos, the ship's medic, Daryl, gave him a shot in the arm and an antiseptic shower to prepare Woody for his first contact with the atmosphere of Lanulos. The first place they visited was Indrid's own house. The house was made of what Woody described as normal everyday bricks and glass, but the house was very beautiful. As Woody entered the house, he had his first contact with someone from Lanulos on Lanulos, Indrid's own children. The first was his oldest, Conrad, who was 12 years old, followed by his son Connor, the second oldest of 10 years old, then finally Indrid's youngest, a little girl named Kimilis, only 5 months old. He was taken on a tour of the house by the Colds and was fascinated by only a few differences compared to a typical Earth home. One being the stove in the kitchen slash dining room area, and the other being the laundry room, which was completely different to what you might expect on Earth. The entire room was the washer and dryer. Clothes were simply hung on different size hooks and racks, and when the door closed, they were sprayed by the room with a sanitizing spray and dried in a dehumidified air, which also left the clothes wrinkle-free. After the tour of the house, Indrid took Woody on a tour of the closest city, or what the planet of Lanulos calls a gathering. On Lanulos, the cities were not given names like those on Earth. They were given numbers instead. This one was called 27 Gathering. Some very noticeable features of this quote-unquote gathering were the sidewalks were moving for you, and you stood on them and were simply taken forward in your chosen direction. Everyone was nude. The people of Lanulos only wore clothes for warmth, and on days that clothes were not needed, they simply didn't wear any. And this, of course, made Woody stick out like a sore thumb. Many of the Lanulos were hesitant to talk or approach Woody, but after Indrid had told them exactly who Woody was, a few were more comfortable with talking to him and shaking his hand. Soon after, Indrid and Carl took Woody into a restroom and asked him to get undressed. This was so that they could continue their business and not draw so much attention to Woody and the group. This time, Woody stood out in a different way. On Lanulos, there were very few underweight or overweight people. And Woody, being an overweight man, he still ended up drawing some attention to himself. Their first stop was a department store where Woody had his hands held by Indrid and Kimmy, as it was not allowed for Woody to bring anything back to Earth from Lanulos. So for good measure, they held his hands. Then they headed to a factory where everything is similar to procedures on Earth. And one major difference was how people washed up before leaving work. There was a large pool of sorts that had soap and overhead sprayers that people would walk through and clean themselves as they exited the facility. After that, they took a trip in what Woody best describes as a Lanulosian car, which had no wheels and hovered over long ditches, which acted as their roads. At the bottom of the ditches, there were massive jets of air that kept the vehicles floating. Their trip took only about 10 minutes as they traveled around 30 miles, which calculates to roughly 180 miles per hour, and at the end of their trip in the car, they found themselves at 28 Gathering. The last place they visited was to a small farm where Woody met a family that had relocated to Lanulos from Earth. Now, John and Carolyn Peterson were from Acapulco, Mexico, and have been on Lanulos for 40 years. Woody was a little shocked by this, as they only looked to be about 50 years old and were very athletic and active. John told Woody that he was actually around 90 Earth years old and that the planet of Lanulos does wonders for an Earthling's body. The Petersons raised 7 children on Lanulos and had zero interest in ever returning to Earth. When Woody arrived back on Earth, it was roughly 10 p.m., and they were met by Clennell and her Volkswagen, who dropped her off at his truck. Jim and the Humanoids. One night, a young man by the name of Jim Hackett knocked on Woody's door and asked if he knew anywhere that he could see UFOs clearly at night. Woody told him that the best place was a few miles outside of town at a place called Boggle Ridge, and the best time was just shortly after dark. A few nights later, Jim had returned to tell Woody about something that had happened to him one night when out on Boggle Ridge. After the recommendation from Woody to check out this Boggle Ridge, Jim went out there and saw exactly what he was looking for. The problem was that nobody believed him. So the night after, he took his cousin Darla Sarter out to the spot. It was a stormy night and there was no way to see any stars as the clouds were very thick. But soon after they got there, a brightly lit craft was descending towards them and seemed to land behind where they were parked. Then, Jim began to hear a voice in his head, followed by a tapping on the passenger side window that scared the living shit out of him. Whoever had knocked on the window walked to the back of the car and telepathically asked if that was his wife. Jim was scared but answered out loud, "No, that's my cousin." The voice in his head asked him to come for a walk with him and to leave her and the car with the doors locked and that you'll be back soon. Jim reluctantly did as was asked and was brought to a pinkish metal craft that had another human-like being standing near it. These beings asked for his moccasins and told him that they would give them back soon. Jim yet again did as was asked and returned to the car. The next night he came back to Woody's to ask if Woody could come with him and Darla to retrieve his shoes back from the beings at the same location tonight. Woody agreed and told them that he would be bringing a friend along. At this time, Woody reached out telepathically to Indrid and told him of what happened, in which Indrid replied saying that this was not his people. Jim, Darla, and Woody arrived on the ridge and parked the car at the same place Jim was parked the night prior. As the three men walked down the road to where the craft was to be, three silhouettes stood in the tree line, following them down the road. These shadows were Indrid Cold, Carl Ardo, and another of Indrid's crew, Demo Hassan. As Woody and the group approached the craft, the trio of Lanyologians approached from the back and forced the beings back into their ship. Indrid knew exactly who they were and explained that they were what they referred to as humanoids, and that they were from an entirely different galaxy. They had very human-like features, except for the areas immediately around their eyes and the hairs on their heads, which were more quill than hair-like. On their planet, the rules of possessions are a bit different. If someone finds something, it is now theirs. So in their culture, when they ask you for your shoes, they were not meaning to be rude. They probably wanted them to help fit in here on Earth, but you were never going to get them back. In fact, if they hadn't come with, they would have probably persuaded Jim and Woody to give them everything that they had. Indrid continued by telling Woody to take everyone back to his house and that Jim would get his shoes back soon. The last thing they saw was Indrid's ship escorting the humanoid ship out of the area. And the next morning, Jim's belongings were on his front porch and cleaned. Another encounter with the humanoids. In February 1967, shortly after the events with Jim Hackett, Woody received a phone call from an unnamed but apparently well-known doctor from Vienna, West Virginia. The doctor told Woody that there were two large pink ships floating low above his house. Woody invited the doctor and his family to join the Derenbergers at their house. As the family traveled to Woody's, the UFOs followed. When they got to Woody's house and he saw that these ships followed them there, Woody reached out telepathically to Indrid. Shortly after, nine ships, including Indrid's, showed up and escorted the pink ships to a field near Woody's house. Indrid reached out telepathically to Woody and told him that they were going to escort the humanoids to the fringe of our galaxy and that they had agreed to never return. Later, Indrid would tell Woody that these beings were the ones that Betty and Barney Hill had encountered in their very famous alien abduction story in September of 1961. Other contactees. There have been a few other people who have come in contact with one or more of the characters in Woody's story. According to Woody, these are those people. A man from Ripley, West Virginia, told author John Keel of his encounter with a man by the name of Clinell from a planet called Cerebus. The man who he refers to has never met Woody, and they have never talked before. But yet, they both have stories not only including Clinell, but others from Lanyulos as well. Another man who had encounters with people from Lanyulos was a man by the name of Kevin from Woody's hometown of Parkersburg, West Virginia. Kevin and Woody worked together for a little while and even developed the ability to communicate telepathically over long distances. On two occasions, Woody and Kevin proved their ability of telepathy to their boss, who quickly changed his mind and now believes in their abilities. A couple from Belpre, Ohio, by the names of Dan and Wilma, have met Indrid Cold and Demo Hassan on a few occasions as the Derenberger residents. They have become good friends of the people from space. A woman and her two friends had an encounter with a ship and the two people from Cerebus named Jitro and Elvain Kleta. the encounter happened after a visit to her new summer home with her parents, and it ended with her feeling very uneasy. The next night, when she came back, she saw a large craft in the sky directly over the Little Kanawha River, where her cabin was located, and left. The next night, she showed up with her two friends, Mary and Grace, and they witnessed the crafts lowering down to the ground and waved to her neighbor, a man by the name of Woody Derenberg. A doctor by the name of Alan Roberts visited Woody at his home in November of 1966. Dr. Roberts was interested in Woody's story and requested to talk with the men from space. Woody told him that he would reach out to Indrid and tell him that he was interested in talking with him. One day, when the doctor and his wife were over at Woody's house, one of their children had called to tell them that there was a man in their house and that the other two children were hiding upstairs. The doctor and his wife sped home and were stunned to find a note written on the fogged up kitchen window saying, quote, "Left because of children. We'll come back another time. Demo." Demo obviously being Demo Hassan, one of the men from planet Cerebus. Dr. Roberts was visiting the Derenbergers one night in late December of 1966 when a craft landed on Woody's property and Demo exited, and Dr. Roberts finally got his chance to meet a man from space. Since then, he has met with Indrid and a few others and has even learned to speak telepathically with the others that share the ability. A woman by the name of Ellen Paris had an episode with her health at a grocery store one day. Before this episode, she had been in contact with Indrid and very much wanted to go to Lanulos after being offered, but she was afraid of flying and could not gather the courage to board the spacecraft and fly through space to a planet far, far away. During her health issue, she remembered a man through her painful haze who asked her if she wanted to go to Lanulos. She replied yes, and was driven to a rural area and remembers getting to Lanulos and being escorted through what she called Gathering 27 by two women who matched the physical descriptions of Butyline Voss and Kimmy Cole. On July 19, 1969, Woody was giving a lecture at the University of Youngstown to a small group of professors from the university. After the lecture was done, he took the group outside and called for a showing of the spacecraft via telepathy. Not only one, but two craft showed up. They didn't land, and the group didn't have contact with actual people from the ships, but the display alone was enough to convince many that Woody was serious about everything he said. Another ship landed in Parkersburg in July of 1968 and was witnessed by many people, including two police officers. On August 31st, 1968, Woody was giving a small lecture to a few people at the home of Roger and Mabel Sherman. As his tradition, after lecture, he took them all outside and began telepathically requesting a show of a ship. This time, a man showed up in the tree line of the woods and spoke to Woody's mind. This man was Demo Hassan, the man from the planet Cerebus. Woody began to walk and to talk to him, and the owner of the house, Roger Sherman, began to follow Woody. Soon after, Demo began to run away, and Roger ran in pursuit, and Woody followed at a distance. Roger followed Demo for a while into a heavily wooded area, and as he was about to enter the area far behind Demo, he noticed a ship in the air emitting large red spark-like substances and ran back to Woody instead of going any closer. Demo reached out to Woody, telling him not to bring anyone closer than they are right now, as they are having issues with their gravity coils and are running troubleshooting at the moment. Woody and Roger watched for a few minutes in awe before going back to Roger's house and grabbing everyone else so that they could see the spectacular showing of an actual spacecraft up close. Woody watched as everyone stared in amazement and some in fear, and was very happy that he was doing exactly what Indrid wanted of him. One other public showing of an unidentifiable craft was credited to Woody at another small lecture, this time at the home of Miss Rose North of Avon Lake, Ohio. A student named Ed.
You have goals. Reach them fast with IU Online's accelerated degree programs. Our 6 and 8 week courses are taught 100% online and can fit any schedule. Advance your career with a bachelor's in informatics. It only takes 10 minutes to apply. Earn an Indiana University degree that's valued around the world. Get started today at IU Online.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
During a radio interview in Washington, D.C., a man by the name of Ed called into the show claiming that he, too, has been taking allanulose. After the recording, the producer gave Woody the man's number, and Woody called to set up a time that they could meet and talk together. The man was a college senior from Adelphi, Maryland, and was very happy to hear Woody's story as it matched his own very closely. Woody brought with him to Ed's house author and investigator John Keel and a man by the name of Harold Sackham from SACI. During the drive to Ed's house, Harold Sackham asked Woody if he would be able to determine whether or not the man was lying. Woody replied by telling the man in the car about a craft that resembled a carpet or sled. If Ed discussed this craft at all, then Woody would be inclined to believe him, as he had never told anybody about this craft. And Ed's story goes exactly like this. At around 1:15 a.m. on Sunday, December 10th, 1967, he was driving home outside of Washington, D.C., when he noticed a large, white, egg-shaped object in the middle of the road. He stopped his vehicle about 20 feet from the object and saw two men standing outside of it with tan skin and light blue coveralls. One man walked up to the driver's side of his vehicle with a large grin on his face and told Ed not to fear him and that his name was Vadig. They conversed for several minutes and Vadig asked Ed several questions like, where was he from, where was he going, and what did he do for a living? Shortly after the conversation started, Vadig told Ed, quote, I'll see you in time. And he returned to the object where a door opened up and he and the other man entered into said object before it began to lift off the ground and fly away. A second contact with Vadig happened when Ed was working as a waiter at a local restaurant and Vadig walked in and sat down. Now Vadig asked Ed if he remembered him and Ed said yes he did. Ed was a little concerned because he did not tell this man that he worked at this restaurant. They talked very little and Ed brought Vadig a coffee. At this time, Vadig asked him if they could meet up later and Ed accepted. That night, Ed was being driven home from a coworker. The moment that he had gotten out of the car, a black Buick had driven up and a door opened which revealed Vadig and another man sitting in the car. Ed got in the Buick and they drove for about 30 minutes to a remote location where they found the craft where Ed had seen fly away the other night. Once on board, he was brought into a room with a chair and a TV. He sat down and the TV showed the ground traveling away from the screen and then eventually the Earth itself shrinking until it was no more. After a short while, another planet came into view and they began to land. Once they exited the craft, they jumped on board a car with no wheels that drove along long ditches and Vadig explained that this was Lanulose. Vadig continued to use that name, Lanulos, a lot, as if he was attempting to highlight the name for importance or make the name stick in Ed's memory. The people of Lanulos were mostly nude, and there were some very attractive women, according to Ed. They all shared the very dark complexion of Vadig, and were all in great shape. When they were done, they returned to the ship, and Ed took a seat in front of the TV again, and he was returned to the same place with the Buick waiting to take him home. After another 30-minute drive home, he found that only an hour and 30 minutes had passed since he was dropped off. After he told Woody and the others his story, it was clear that Woody was really talking to another visitor to Lanulos, because Ed did mention the sled-like ships that the people of Lanulos used on a regular occasion. Indrid and the Derenbergers. Catherine Derenberger was petrified of the idea of meeting people from another planet. She went out of her way many times when they were around the house to not be in contact with them and would only come back downstairs with her son Charles when Woody told her that they were gone. One day, she answered a knock on the door and there were two men who were selling vacuums door to door who were requesting to demonstrate their newest model for her. She told them that her husband was an appliance salesman and that they have a brand new vacuum, but thank you. The men understood, then began to ask her about her husband's events with the men from space. She told them in the best way she could explain that Woody had gone through the first night. Then, one of them asked if she had ever met them. She replied by saying no, but it wasn't because she hadn't had an opportunity. She was just a little frightened from the whole situation. Then, the two men began to smile. She made the connection between the two men standing in front of her and her husband's description of Indra Cold and Carl Ardo. Since that day, she has had conversations with them many times and thinks of them as very good friends to hers. Although their youngest child, their daughter Tanya, was very young during these events with Injured Cold, she was always the first to spot the ship following them in their car. She has played with both Injured and Carl multiple times and looks forward to their visits. Venus and the Kletos. One April day in 1967, Woody was invited to go to visit the home of Jitro and Elvain Kletos of what we call Venus. Woody described the ship they used to get to the flagship, or mothership, as a Venetian scout craft, and was what everyone recognized as a typical flying saucer. This craft was not meant to fly far distances, such as from Earth to Venus, so they had to stop at the mothership before traveling to Venus. According to Woody's description, the surface of this planet is very flat. There are slight hills, but no mountains like Earth. There seemed to be more ocean than land, and most of the land that he saw was cultivated into long stretches of crops. The rest of the land was covered in dense forests and small bodies of water, such as rivers and streams. He explained that according to Jitro, the temperature was steadily between 100 and 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and the only time that they wore clothes were for fancy gatherings like dances. He described the people as having a yellowish skin and again failed to find anyone who was too thick or thin. Everyone looked in really great shape. He wasn't able to stay too long as he was expected to be at work the next day, but he wished he was able to stay longer than he had. Some questions answered. Why do they come here, and what do they want from Woody? They come to Earth for the simple task of helping their brothers and sisters. They believe heavily, due to their own religious beliefs, that they should help us by eventually welcoming us to the collection of human civilizations that speckle the Milky Way. By doing this, we can trade culture, medicine, and technology. Well, then why don't they just land in a public area? They want to, but the first few times they tried, they were shot at and even chased by military missiles and aircraft. They are afraid that if they showed up on the front lawn of the White House, they would only be free to go when it was decided by the governments of Earth. They don't want to be prisoners and they don't believe in war. So their plan is to contact those select few that they believe can help and go through them slowly and methodically until the coast is completely clear and the people of Earth are ready for them. Chapter 2, Tanya Derenberger. The First Night. In Tanya Derenberger's book, Beyond Lanulos, she dives deeper into her father's story and tells of her experiences living with the man who talks with spacemen. In the second chapter of the book, she tells of what she remembers of the events of the night of Injured Cold's first contact with her father, and even adds a little more to the story that was not in Woody's book. In addition to the story that her father tells, she adds that there was a time of the night on November 2nd, 1966, when four men knocked on the front door of their home. These men were all dressed in black suits, white undershirts, nice black ties, and wore black sunglasses even in the dead of night. At first, she thought that they were people from the church, who may have heard of what happened and come to check in on the family, but as one of the men looked directly at her, she realized that these were not God-fearing men. The men told her father to not tell anyone of his experience that night. Woody replied by telling him that he had already reached out to law enforcement. Their reply was for him to retract all of his statements, and according to Tanya, this made them angry, and they left in a large black car. She told of how she later found out that these were supposedly the infamous Men in Black. The Lanulosians. Tanya remembers many visits from the Lanulosians with her family at their house. She tells of how Kimmy Cold would talk with her mother and how she would play with Indrid's two sons, who were a few years older than her. They would play with her brother's toy cars, and the space boys would tell her how they don't have any cars on their planet. These visits from the Coles were fairly regular. She said that when she first met Indrid, he would talk to her using vocal words and didn't start talking to her telepathically until she was about 14 years old. She described Carl Ardo as being tall and skinnier than Indrid. He had slicked back hair and was very similar looking to Indrid, and she even describes a time that she was able to play with his daughter, Mystique. Tanya and the other children shared many descriptions about life on the other planets. The Lanulosians were very in tune with the teachings of the Bible and spent a lot of time studying it. They were shocked that we only stay in school until we are 18, where on Lanulos the amount of time spent on school would equal to about 28 Earth years. And you didn't start school until you reached a certain maturity, not a certain age. She adds details about their diet as well. The food on Lanulos is all grown organically and as natural as they can. Fast food doesn't exist. and apparently they can't stay for too long on Earth because the atmosphere makes them younger. At one point near the middle of the book, she briefly gives a description of Demo Hassad. He, just like Injured and Carl, were tall and tanned with slick back black hair, but what made him different was his skittishness. Demo did not feel comfortable around people he didn't know, and he was one of the last spacemen Tanya had the chance to meet due to him having to build the nerve to come to the Derenbergers' house. She described how most of the time the mob of people were outside of their house, Indrid and Carl were there mixed in with the crowd of UFO enthusiasts. To most people, they looked just like any other human being on Earth. Her father never knew the exact reason why they did that, but his best guess was that it was a mixture of keeping a watchful and protective eye on the Derenbergers and also to listen to the gossip that was going on around about them. Trouble at home. She also talked about how her mother became very upset with the situation that the family was in due to these space people. Not only was she upset that they kept moving and people kept finding them, and even after leaving their number and addresses unlisted, but because everywhere she went, Indrid or Carl were there watching her. Woody was even able to tell her where she had been all day, who she had talked to, and what she bought because Indrid would telepathically tell Woody everything. She started feeling like Woody was having them spy on her for reasons she couldn't understand. And when Indrid started watching the kids too, that's when it got really bad. She talks about how her father began seeing Darla Sarter, the cousin of Jim, who was left in the car while Jim got shoes stolen by the humanoids. And this happened while her parents were still together. In the meantime, a man by the name of Bob Lalonde of the Cleveland Ufology Group began spending a lot more time at the Derenberger house. Catherine eventually left Woody and moved to Cleveland, where she and the kids lived with Bob. Her parents eventually divorced, and her mother was remarried to Bob. New characters. Towards the back of the book, she introduces us to a few other key characters in the big scheme of things and better details the family's first contact with author and investigator John Keel from New York. She described how on his first night that she showed up at their door, he had seen lights in the sky just over the hill. So he went to see if they were maybe headlights in the distance, and in order to do that, he had to climb a fence and a hill on the other side. He soon found out it was an electric fence and then fell into a large muddy puddle on the other side. He did end up getting his answer that there were no roads back behind the hill and also got chased by Woody's neighbor's bull. This story was also recounted in Woody's and Gary Barker's book as well. Speaking of Gary Barker, she also introduced us to him. He was a writer and author of UFO books for his Saucerian Press. He was the man who originally convinced Woody to publish his story, although ultimately Woody's story would be published by Harold Hubbard instead. We will get to him more here in a little bit. But one very interesting thing she adds to all of this is that one day Muhammad Ali showed up at the Derenbergers' house to talk about Woody's experience. Ali was a world-famous champion boxer and also claimed to have a few run-ins with UFOs as well. So he claimed to be very interested in her father's story. When Woody finally published his book, he sent a signed copy to Ali, who often brought it ringside as his good luck charm. Ali even showed up on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson with Woody's book, claiming it gave him good luck. The end. At the end of her book, she tells how at her father's funeral, there were many people there. A lot of chatter was about whether Indrid would show up or not. According to her, he was there, and so were his two sons. Indrid no longer comes to Earth and has now successfully handed all responsibility over the protection of certain Earth families over to his two sons. Tanya still has telepathic conversations with Indrid, but now only sees Conard and Connor, Indrid's two sons. There are updates about all of the characters from Lanyelos and Cerebus, but I am going to leave those out because I don't want to give too much of the book away. I only intend to give the story critical information and not take away from anyone else's hard work. One of the absolute biggest surprises came at the end of the book and personally had my mind blown by the author of the epilogue in Tanya's book, that being from an investigator by the name of Andy Colvin, who had shown Tanya one of the only supposed pictures of the famous, quote-unquote, stranger at the Pentagon, Valiant Thor. Tanya replied with, quote, "This is the man who represented himself as Indrid Cold to her family." Who was Gray Barker? Let's start off the conversation about Gray Barker with a question. Who was Gray Barker? Ray Barker was a ufology and alien author who was famous for not being a true believer himself. After his death in 1984, his sister told many about how Gray only wrote books for the money, and his friend and fellow authors James W. Moseley was very open about telling everyone the truth about Barker, saying, quote, "He pretty much took all the ufology as a joke." Gray even referred to his own paranormal writings as his quote-unquote kooky books. So, why are you telling us about a man if he didn't even take these subjects seriously? Well, because many, and I mean many, of the mainstream quote-unquote facts about Indra Cold and many other subjects of the matter are only considered because Gray Barker wrote them in his books and talked about them with the community. So in order to dodge a lot of people saying I missed a lot of stuff, I wanted to go through Gray Barker's own book, The Night the Earth Stood Still, The Strange Case of Indra Cold, and highlight what a lot of people know as facts that don't show up in more reputable source materials, such as the ones from the Derenbergers themselves and author and investigator John Keel. Even though he is known as an author that stretched the truth in order to create a more spicy story, he was still personally present for a lot of the strange events that can be backed up and verified by many reputable sources. He was also a man that was surrounded in conspiracy as well. Many believe that he worked closely with the CIA and other three-letter government organizations, and purposely put over-the-top information in his works to discredit the community. And some believe that he was an alien, or Lanyelogian himself. So let's dive into this book he wrote about Indra Cold and see some of the differences in the story that very well may have been fabricated by Gray Barker himself. Chapter 1. Chapter 1 in this book takes place before the first meeting between Indra Cold and Woody Derenberger. In this chapter, he introduces four characters: Indra Cold, Carl Ardo, Demo Hassan, and Commander Valiant Thor. The reason why this is important is because Valiant Thor was not mentioned in anything written by either Woody or John Keel. If you remember, I said that the picture of Valiant Thor was mentioned in the epilogue of Tanya's book, which was written by someone else. Another piece of the story that doesn't match up is that when he introduces Demo Hassan, he introduces him as, quote, "the youngest and most impetuous of the crew." Impetuous meaning carefree or headstrong, where Tanya Derenberger described him as being a skittish and cautious man. When Woody met Indrid. In Gray Barker's accounts of the first meeting between Indra Cold and Woody, there are a few differences that jump off the page at you when you read it. The first thing I notice is how he claims that the lightless craft that began to tail him lifted over his truck instead of passing him on his left, and then lowered itself in front of him before coming to a complete stop. Another thing that stuck out was that immediately after the event, he described Woody's thoughts about what had just happened. In his thoughts, he thought of a TV show that his wife enjoyed watching called The Joe Pyne Show, and one particular episode where a man from California told a story about alien beings who looked like humans brought him on a trip in their ship to their home on Venus. I didn't see any mention of this in other writings, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't true. Barker did have many interviews with Woody Derenberger where he could have gotten additional information from him. Remember, Gray Barker was originally the publisher who was going to publish Woody's story. Beeps and clicks. In an early chapter of his book, Gray Barker briefly mentions an event that without previously reading John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies, I don't think I would have been able to pick up on, let alone understand the reference. While he was on the phone with James W. Moseley, a friend, fellow ufology author, and editor of Saucer News, mentions that during their conversation, they both heard a beeping sound followed immediately by a series of clicks. This prompted Barker to state, quote, "There's the silent group again," referring to the mysterious unknown party that has a tendency of tapping and listening in on many different conversations mentioned in John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies. This happened during a conversation in which they were discussing the upcoming visit by Keel with Barker in Parkersburg, in which Keel wished to meet Woody Derenberger to discuss his events. We'll get into this more later on. On the approach of the Derenberger farmhouse, Barker claims to have spotted a car among many others sitting outside of Woody's residence that had men holding various recording and listening devices that looked very strange. Another added piece of the info that was given to Barker and Keel during this visit with Woody was that Lanyelos was 30 light years away. The visit continued with both Keel and Gray requesting for Woody to telepathically request a ship to show over the property. This, of course, was their trump card they thought was going to disprove Woody's claims. Woody replied with, "I will reach out, but I don't always get an answer." This made the men even more confident that Woody was going to have an excuse as to why he couldn't get in contact that night, and Barker and Keel were going to walk out of Woody's house with the feeling that Woody was just another storyteller. When Woody replied with something along the lines of, "I believe if we go take a look out back, you men will be surprised at what you see." This, of course, got the two investigators excited, and the group went out the back door and looked up towards a hill belonging to Woody's neighbor. There were lights just above the crest that both Barker and Keel thought were simply passing traffic on a highway far in the distance, but there were other lights further above the hill that were much harder to explain. This is when we get the story of John Keel climbing the electric fence and being chased by Woody's neighbor's bull. According to Keel, the man who climbed the hill to see the lights, there was a highway in the distance, but may not have been able to explain a majority of the lights, and definitely was not able to explain the ones that were further above the land. Soon after, the group returned to Woody's house, and soon after that, the men witnessed a large red globe in the sky, half the size of the moon, that seemed to flicker in and out of existence. It was noted that this object was far too big to be a planet. The men returned to the hotel that Keel was staying at and discussed the night's events. One thing that Barker had pointed out was that the technology that was in Woody's story was strange. Some of it was very normal, everyday earthbound technology such as bunk beds, radios, and space helmets. From the point of view of Barker, if Woody was lying, he most likely would have thought of far-out technologies for every single task. But since there were some familiar technologies, this may lend truth to the idea that there may be more of a connection between Earthlings and Lanielosians, and what Woody witnessed were the technologies that they liked of ours. According to John Keel in Barker's book, there were two outcomes from the visit. One, portions of, or the whole story is true. And two, the man is doing a really good job at trying to sell a story. Neither one of them Keel saw as a problem for the human race. The conversation takes a turn when Barker points out something that he and James W. Mosley were talking about in reference to Keel. He stated that Mosley and himself both realized after talking with John Keel that he was gathering a lot of information for something he knew more than he was leading on about these events. Keel, of course, said, this is mostly true. He began by stating that he was in fact writing another book, but that's not why he was secretive with his findings. He claimed to have found that there were very little substance to a lot of reports, and that the truly interesting things were not in the objects of the reports, but more about the other quote-unquote smaller details that others are not paying attention to. Because of this, he began from the beginning with all of the events that he has investigated, and he has discovered some very interesting details tied to most of the reputable ones. He had found these details due to his task of forgetting all of the work done by the others and revisiting the events with a blank and open mind. By doing this, he was able to look at the phenomenon without influence. It was because of this that he did not come forward with his findings and thoughts. Because if he did, people would mold their experience to his findings and he wouldn't know which to believe and which not to believe. My example of this is, what if he told everyone that the real encounters are the ones that show up in purple ships shaped like a hockey puck and trees growing on the underside of it? Well, now all you're going to get is people saying that they've seen ships that match this description, and all of your findings are now going to be diluted. Another reason that Keel pointed out was that he didn't want his findings to be used politically. He explained that there are a lot of different UFO research groups out there that would use his info for only their own benefit, and not for the benefit of the actual search for UFOs. He claimed that a UFO research group like NICAP has put more time and effort into fighting entities like MUFON and the Air Force than it puts into the actual task it sets advertised as its purpose. He did go on to give a hint that he believes them to be more of environmental entities than from outer space. He explained this by stating that it seems that they have always been here and live more besides us than just visiting us. He says that he has found way more evidence of this than the dismal, if any, evidence for them coming from outer space. He believed that all of the quote-unquote leaked info about the UFOs variously stated that there was no evidence of extraterrestrial origins, and he believes that this could be true. The true home planet. There are many theories as to what and where Lanuos may actually be. As highlighted by Mr. Barker in his book, The Night the Earth Stood Still, there are people who believe that Venetians visit Earth regularly and tell the abductees that they come from a faraway planet by another name. This would be done for their own security purposes. But where are they actually from? Well, one of the theories is that they are from Venus, of course. But another theory is that they are from here. Some even say that theories about flat Earth and hollow Earth and forgotten continents actually have some weight to them, and that this is where our Lanuosians are actually from. Chapter 3, John Keel. The Mothman Prophecies. For those who may not be familiar with John Keel, he was an American journalist and an extremely influential ufologist, as well as the author of a very famous book called The Mothman Prophecy. John Keel served in the U.S. Army as a member of the Armed Forces Network during the Korean War. After his time in the Army, he became a radio correspondent in France, Germany, Italy, and Egypt. He is the man known for coining the title of the Men in Black, and one of his most important contributions to ufology was the finding and sharing information on the clusters of UFO sightings in a specific area during a specific time he referred to as flaps. In John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, he tells of a handful of UFO sightings just prior to the events involving Woody Derenberger. Although some of these events include the sightings of humanesque shaped beings, one in particular stands out. In November 1966, a man walked into the office of Mary Heyer, reporter for the Athens Press newspaper, nervously stating, "I just got to tell somebody." Miss Heyer, who knew the man, listened to what he had to say and was shocked to hear the detailed story that he claimed just happened a few days ago to him and a co-worker involving a UFO and a human-looking pilot. The story begins with him describing how he and a co-worker were driving home near Parkersburg, West Virginia, on Interstate 77 on November 2nd of 1966 when a strange craft lowered in front of their truck and came to a stop a few feet ahead of them. A man walked out of the hatch that opened from the side of the craft and began to approach the truck. He looked as normal as any man he has ever seen. He was wearing a black sports coat, and his arms were folded in front of him with his hands snug under his armpits. The driver rolled down his window, and the stranger asked a series of strange but short questions. Questions such as, who were they? Where are they from? Where were they going? And what was the time? After the short and to-the-point conversation, the man walked back to the craft and got back in it and hovered up into the sky, and the men began to continue their drive. These men are believed to have been in the car that passed Woody Derenberger seconds before his first contact with injured Colt. The men argued between the two of them on whether they should report the incident, and they both came to the conclusion that it would be smart not to. But the man from Point Pleasant found himself having a difficult time continuing his life, with the memory of the event fresh in his head. He suffered from a bad case of insomnia, and when he was able to sleep, he would be terrorized by horrible nightmares. The man soon turned to liquor as an aid, and felt horrible about it, so he chose to tell someone, even if he stayed anonymous. To still protect his co-worker's identity, Mary Heyer, who was a close friend of John Keel's, eventually told Keel about this encounter with the man a few years later and claimed that he was completely unaware of the events with Woody Derenberger. In fact, she believed that the man showed up in her office before the craze with the Derenberger story really hit the news outlets. Keel called the man and had a conversation with him, where Keel was able to validate the story that Mary had told him. The man agreed to every detail he was told by Heyer and told him, quote, "Look, don't use my name. I don't want to get involved in this thing. That scientist fella told me." Before the man could finish, Keel asked, "What scientist?" The man went on to explain that a few weeks after his event, a scientist from Ohio came to see him and his co-worker and told them to be quiet about the event and that it would be better if we forgot the whole thing. The man claimed that his events happened on the same night, on the same road, and the same area as Woody Derenberger's event, but had zero idea at the time of Woody's story or anyone else's. Between police records and other newspaper and radio station records, there were at least three others from the exact same night, road, and area as these two events, with strikingly similar details, two of which were reported before Woody contacted the police office. More details. Just like with every other source of mine for this topic, there are details that are added with Keel's telling of Woody's story. Here is what I found. Mr. Cold was sporting a large grin, and under his top coat, he was wearing a shiny metallic greenish shirt. These particular details are common in many tellings of the story and have been quoted coming from Woody himself by many people. Keel goes on to add that a few people had come forward after hearing Woody's story and confirmed that they drove by him pulled over on the side of the road, having a conversation with a man who didn't seem to have a vehicle. No one saw the craft hovering over Woody's position. Mr. Keel also has more info to add about the time surrounding when Woody appeared on the Long John Nevels radio talk show. A year prior to the recording, Dr. Morgan, the doctor who administered the psychiatric tests on Woody due to Nightcap's request, was watching a football game at his house when he began to feel a very strange sensation wash all over him, in which he believed was being caused by a craft hovering over his home. This was the beginning of his journey as a contactee. During the recording, Long John phoned Dr. Morgan and he reiterated his experiences to Woody and the panelists as well as anybody listening to the show that day. The other strange instances. There were many other instances from the book The Mothman Prophecies that could have been tied into the events of Injured Cold or the Mothman or both. One strange occurrence was the fact that many people reported door-to-door salesmen traveling the area selling different things at each door. Sometimes it was appliances, sometimes it was Bibles, sometimes shoes, sometimes they would claim that they were census takers. This strangeness wouldn't be too strange if it weren't for the fact that many have claimed to talk to their neighbors immediately after the group visited both houses to find that they were selling something completely different to their neighbor. These quote-unquote salesmen would always ask peculiar questions such as, how many children were in the house? They always seemed to be very interested in the children for some reason. One woman was even going around claiming to be John Keel's secretary. She would give those who had been subjects of Keel's a form with questions about their personal lives and the events in which they saw the UFOs. Now, John Keel does not and did not ever have a secretary, by the way. And the most curious thing about this secretary of Keel's is that she even visited the people that Keel never wrote about, meaning that ones that wanted to stay anonymous. These visitors would most often show up at people's homes shortly after the witness's event. To Keel, this was a textbook Men in Black activity. Now, when I read this, I thought to myself that this sounded like people who were checking out houses to steal from, but then I remembered that in Woody's book, Visitors from Lanulos, there was a time when Catherine Derenberger, Woody's wife, answered the door and two men who turned out to be Injured Cold and Demo Hassan were attempting to sell her a vacuum cleaner. This ended up being her first face-to-face contact with the Lanulosians. Another strange instance that you read about all through Keel's book is the act of people attempting to talk on their personal phones and being interrupted by loud beeping and whirling sounds. This did happen to Keel himself a lot, but was not specific to him alone. This happened to a lot of people talked about in his book, and many of them called the phone company to have them run a check of their wiring, and every time they came back with no problems. Sooner or later, Keel ended up finding out that his line was being tapped by a sort of mechanism. The strangeness with the phones didn't end there. This sound would be heard even when people would receive calls with no one answering on the other end. Some people, even Woody himself, went as far as getting a new number and leaving it unlisted. But that didn't help, as the sound continued to find them. One more strange piece of evidence about this sound: it seemed to only affect those that were either contactees or those that witnessed UFOs in the sky. Another quick thing to know about the Ohio Valley area in 1966 and 67 is that Keel highlighted in his book that there was a small explosion of animal mutilations at the time. Dogs, cats, rabbits, cows, deer, and horses were all being left dead randomly around the valley with all the blood removed from them. There was no blood to be found around them, and in most cases they had a large hole cut into the animal, sometimes in the head removing the brain, sometimes in the chest removing the heart, and sometimes in completely random places. One particular case was very interesting, and that was the TNT area, the area synonymous with being the favorite area of the Mothman. Just prior to the real snap of Mothman sightings and events through the Ohio Valley, Was this the Mothman's doing, injured colds, or another completely unrelated set of events? Jane. In his book, John Keel tells of a woman he met who he refers to as Jane, which many people have concluded was a woman by the name of J.P. Parra, who Keel refers to as a contact he had that put him in touch with Jane. But for this, we are going to refer to her as Jane, as Keel did, since we do not have the proof that this was in fact Miss Parra. Jane lived near an area known as Mount Misery in Huntington, New York. Keel goes on to describe Mount Misery as a, quote, very heavily wooded hill with a few dirt roads with a number of mysterious deaths and disappearances. Jane and her boyfriend had been sucked into all the mysteries and disappearances that all the locals were talking about and decided to drive up to Mount Misery one night and investigate for themselves. At one point in the night, they found themselves driving back down the road when her boyfriend Richard begins to complain of not feeling very well. After he pulls the car over, he slumps over the steering wheel and falls unconscious. And what seems to be right on cue, a bright light engulfs the car, and the next thing either of them know, they are driving on Old Country Road at the bottom of Mount Misery with no recollection of how they got there or what happened after the light appeared. A few days later, her phone rang and an unknown voice told her to go to a local library and find a particular book and read page 42. The next day, she did as the caller asked, and when she got there, she met a very strange librarian who was dressed in clothes from the 40s. Jane described this lady as having a darker complexion with a fine bone structure and very black eyes and hair. When she asked her for the book she was looking for, the librarian reached under her desk and pulled out the exact book as if she was waiting for Jane. As she sat down and turned to page 42, the print literally transformed into another text telling her why she was selected and that the author had messages concerning Earth and its people. Then the author explained that she was allowed to tell one other person but no more than that, and it was signed, "Be in peace, Apal." As she finished reading, the text transformed back to normal. Soon after she left the library, she became very ill and soon got in touch with John Keel to pass on her story. Keel tells of how he held a bit of info from her about a distant contactee who is in contact with an Apolis. Keel saw the signature at the end of John's reading of Apal was similar to Apolis and wanted to see if she was going to lead him down a familiar path. A couple of weeks later, Jane claimed to have been seeing the librarian everywhere she went. One particular encounter with this woman was worrisome to Jane. She was in a local department store when the librarian came out from behind a rack and began speaking to Jane in broken English and still wearing the same outfit from weeks ago. She began laughing hysterically when Jane asked her if she lived around the area that they were in. The lady then asked Jane, quote, "Is there any AU here?" Keel took this as she was asking for gold, since the symbol for gold on the periodic table is the letters AU. Jane was unable to sleep that night and got up early and headed out for a walk. The librarian stepped out from an alley and told Jane, quote, "Peter is coming." And Jane remembered that Catholics believed that the final pope was going to be named Peter. The only reference I could find to this, by the way, was from the fictional novel The Roman Peter II, The Last Pope, by George R. Arroyo Matiz. Just after a large black Cadillac with an olive-skinned driver stopped next to the woman and a very tanned man who dressed like a very important person stepped out of the vehicle with a large grin on his face. He shook her hand and introduced him as Apal. Apal gave Jane a folded-up piece of paper with a very small disc inside and told her to always keep it on her to let the really good people know who she was. Jane mailed the gift to Keel, and Keel was very unimpressed with either the paper or disc, which was the size of a quarter. But when Keel mailed it back to her, Jane received the package with the disc bent in half. Now, this did interest Keel, as he believed that whoever had given it to Jane had access to the mail system and was able to access things in closed-off packaging. The reason why he was interested in this was because he had either mailed off or was mailed very important things dealing with his investigations that failed to reach their intended destination, even though the packaging was fine. Another month later, and after regular visits from Apal and a few others, she was presented with three pills. One for now, one for in 2 days, and a third for her to have someone dissect for her assurance that there isn't anything harmful in it. She turned the pill over to Kiel, of course, who had it tested, and it came out that the contents proved to be a drug normally prescribed for infection of the urinary tract. After she took the first pill, she contracted a terrible headache and lost sight in her right eye. 2 days later, she took the second pill with no side effects. The same day, a man claiming to be Colonel John Dalton of the Air Force called her at her house and told her he wanted to meet her at her place. And a day later, without her giving him her address, he showed up with another man who was a young lieutenant. The man claiming to be Dalton asked her what she knew of a flying saucer that had landed nearby, and Jane replied with a chuckle and told him that she didn't believe in such things. The man responded by opening his briefcase and pulling out a packet of paperwork for her to fill out. When she refused to do so, he told her it was fine as long as she just signed it. She replied with, "Now that would be pretty stupid." Soon after this, Paul began using Jane as the middleman for contacting Kiel. He told Jane to tell Kiel some very serious and compelling things that ended up coming true. Remember, the date of the publication for this book was June 23, 1975. These things he told Kiel were, 1. Things will become more serious in the Middle East. As we are very aware, conflict in the Middle East never really ended and has been ongoing since before the book was published and long after. 2. The Antichrist would rise up from Israel. This has yet to come true as far as we know. 3. The Pope would head to the Middle East soon and be knifed to death. Now, Pope John Paul I died on September 28, 1978, after only holding the position for 33 days. The official cause of death was a heart attack, but there are many, including others in high-standing positions in the Catholic Church, who believe that he was murdered, and the list of possible murders is pretty impressive. Some include Cardinal Sebastiano Baggio, as Pope John Paul I had removed him from the congregation after being warned about Baggio. 2. Many different members of the Vatican Bank, due to many believing that the new pope was going to investigate internal scandals between the Vatican Bank and organizations such as the Freemasons, the Mafia, and many others in need of money laundering. 3. The CIA. Others believe that John Paul was going to restore the traditional Latin Mass as the norm for the Catholic Church. Another prediction given to Kiel from Appal was that the Vatican was planning to send food and supplies to Arab refugees. This came true shortly after Kiel received the info, but before the book was released, so this is hard to confirm. The most famous prediction was that there was going to be a tragedy on the Ohio River, likely an explosion of a plant of some sorts on the banks of the river. This we will talk about soon. The next few were given to Kiel after he met her in person and put her under hypnosis and had control of the session taken away as Jane started to speak to him, claiming that she was Appal herself. These are the predictions given to Kiel at this time. 1. Pending plane crashes. According to John Kiel, this also came true, but again, hard to confirm with the lack of more info and events happening before publication of the book. 2. Robert Kennedy was in trouble. Robert Kennedy died on June 6, 1968, years before the publishing of this book, so it is hard to determine the authenticity of the prediction. As one of Kiel's last statements about Jane and Appal was that he had to simply think of a question and Jane would call him soon after with an answer from Appal. Chapter 4. Everything else. The Grinning Man. One of the most popular nicknames associated with Injured Cold is the Grinning Man. Some also refer to him as a Smiling Man. The name, the Grinning Man, forces you to believe that Injured Cold is a man who grins. A lot. Maybe all the time. This is both true and not true. Let me explain. The Grinning Man title is given to an entity that seems to follow and even chase down people in the streets and sports a cynical looking grin from ear to ear. The reports from the quote-unquote Grinning Man began on October 16, 1966. Two boys by the names of Martin Mouse Munoff and Jimmy Yonkaitis were walking home along a chain-link fence on 4th Street in Elizabeth, New Jersey, when the boys discovered a very tall man with no hair wearing a shiny green suit staring at them with a very big grin on the other side of the fence. The man chased the boys until the boys eventually were able to lose him. The boys later would report that the man's face was very strange and seemed to lack a nose and ears. This is the event that would give the entity the name the Grinning Man. John Kiel outlines a story that may have been associated with this being in his book, The Mothman Prophecies. He tells of how in 1962, a man by the name of Don Estrella was walking home to his apartment when he became aware of a man following him. Unlike the man a few years later in Jersey, this man was short and had tan skin and wore a long coat, but just like the man who chased the children, he sported a large evil grin. In my opinion, these two stories and others of the Grinning Man seem to not be of Injured Cold. The story that takes place in New Jersey and a select few others seem to be a story involving a paranormal entity that is rarely seen in the US, that being Springheel Jack. The story that includes the man being followed to his house may seem more like Injured Cold with his bronze skin and long coat, but the stalker being short is a dead giveaway that this was not Injured, and instead may have been a different being altogether. Now, you may hear this and think it sounds like a typical stalker story and not much to compare, but stories of the Grinning Man typically follow one of three paths when it comes to the perpetrator's MO and physical description, two of those being the two we just went over. Many different stories involve a Springheel Jack type person sporting a large grin, and many others involve a short man in a large coat also sporting a large grin. Now, the third one, I do believe, could very well be our Lanyelosian. This story involves a girl by the name of Linda Lilly, who lived in Point Pleasant at the time of her encounter. She was a teenager living with her parents in 1967 when she had awoken one night to a tall man standing over her. The man's face was half covered by the shadow casted by her window shade, but she could clearly see a very large grin spread out along his face. When the man started to walk around her bed, she screamed and hid under the blankets, only to come back out a few minutes later and the man was gone. This story has two things that stand out the most to me as possibly being Injured Cold. The time and place, 1967 in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. All other stories that I could find of these tall, athletic, able to jump 6 foot tall chain link fence Injured Colds and short, tanned, wearing their uncle's overcoat Injureds take place in plenty other parts of the country. The tall one typically around the Atlantic seaboard and the short one dang near everywhere, but Linda Lilly's story may be the only story of this Grinning Man actually being described as Injured Cold, strictly because it had to deal with the right place at the right time. Strange people. Injured Cold was far from the only strange human-like figure in the eastern portion of the Ohio Valley in the years of 66 and 67. Another answer to Linda Lilly's story is it could have easily been one of the strange characters that were seen by thousands of other people. Two groups of outsiders made their way into the small towns of central and northern West Virginia and southeastern Ohio. One of these groups were clearly normal humans, but they were suspicious due to their very conservative hairstyles, clothing, and mannerisms. Many believe that these were Air Force or other three-letter agency personnel sent to monitor the UFO, monster, and strange humanoid events that were plaguing this area of the country. The second group were real strange ones, and now that the description of Injured Cold has been made public in many different forms from documentaries to books to website articles, it is clear that these were other beings from the same place that Mr. Cold was from. They sport a darker skin, which most described by those who witnessed them as bronzed, like that of the natives from the South Asian islands. The features were sharp, the lines from their nose, chins, cheeks, and eyes were too straight. They came in all sizes from the very short to the very tall. They wore clothes that were very strange for the late 70s. Most wore clothes that were recently out of style or out of style for 10 to 20 years, and some seemed to wear lightly futuristic clothing with metallic features. They wore very thick sole rubber shoes with jagged treading, similar to those that the astronauts wore on the moon. Those who had personal encounters with them described some having to take pill-like capsules with water in order to calm down their excessive reddening, bloating, and sweating. And one family even claimed to have spotted a green wire coming from one of their shoes and up their slacks as they sat down. These were the people that were going door-to-door selling things, asking about children, requesting entrance into people's homes, coming out as telephone line workers after people were having issues with beeping in their phones, even though they never called the telephone company. It is widely believed that these were the people of Lanyelos, or from wherever they really were from. But one thing was obvious to those that lived in the eastern part of the Ohio Valley in 1966 and 67, and that was that they weren't from there. Mothman. Now, what a lot of people who are not in the know about Injured Cold don't know is that all of these events with the man from Lanyelos happened at the same time as the craziness that ensued with the Mothman sightings and the collapse of the Silver Bridge in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. In Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, he begins his dive into the connections between the events of Mothman and Injured Cold by simply laying a teaser. This teaser states that a National Guardsman was working at the National Guard's armory on the night before Derenberger's event. While working, he saw something large on the limb of a nearby tree that he claimed looked like a large man in a brown suit. He goes on to explain that after looking at it for a while, he determined his final thoughts were that it was some sort of gigantic bird. He left to grab a few buddies to check it out, but when they got there, it was gone. November 15, 1966, just 13 days after Woody Derenberger's events with Mr. Cold, one of the earliest events of the Mothman was about to take place. The famous Scarberry Millet encounter ensued as the two couples were driving through the infamous TNT area, and ended with them being chased by a large black flying creature with gigantic red shining eyes. That is all we will go into on this event for today. Remember, this episode is about Injured Cold, but no worries. Of course, we're going to cover Mothman, and it's going to be soon. I am including these events for timeline purposes and to show the possible relationship between Injured Cold and the Mothman. Altogether, over 100 people witnessed and reported their encounters with the Mothman between 1966 and 1967. The Silver Bridge. Before the legend of the Mothman could be concluded, there was one last event that took place that brought the entire country's eyes to the small town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia. At 5:04 p.m. on December 15, 1967, exactly 13 months to the day after Woody's first contact with Mr. Cold, the Silver Bridge connecting Point Pleasant, West Virginia to Gallipolis, Ohio, collapsed into the icy waters of the Ohio River. The tragic event sent 50 cars and trucks 102 feet to their cold, dark graves as several tons of hardened steel fell after most of the cars, ensuring their fates as they pinned the vehicles and many of their occupants to the bottom of the river. 46 people passed away that evening due to the collapse of the Silver Bridge, and countless others were pulled out of the sub-freezing waters barely holding on to their lives. That night, the Lilly family counted 12 red lights dancing above the tree line from their home on Camp Connolly Road, the most reported to be seen in one place, and they seemed to have been coming from the infamous TNT area. The lights that so many people became so familiar with over the last year or so gathered for their last time in a spectacular showing on the night of the area's largest disaster in history. This final chapter to the extremely strange events surrounding aliens, lights, and flying humanoid monsters that plagued the eastern portions of the Ohio Valley ended in both the death of many that forever ruined families in the area and a brilliant finale of red lights bidding their end to the place they visited so frequently. And this horrific night all began that same morning when people claimed to have seen strange men in brand new blue coveralls inspecting the bridge. And hours before the deadliest disaster in this little town's history, a large crowd witnessed what the locals believed to be the Mothman flying over the bridge, starting a long string of coincidences of the figure being described as a harbinger of disaster and possibly a puppet of beings from another world. The end. Well, that's it, everybody. That is my entire presentation on the Injured Cold story. Woody Derenberger, Tanya Derenberger, John Keel, all of this. Absolutely phenomenal stuff. The Injured Cold story took a completely different turn in my life as an archivist of all of these incredible stories. You know, I was absolutely blessed to be one of the few that got a chance to actually talk to Tanya Derenberger. Thank you, Ashers, by the way, for that. And she was such a beautiful person, beautiful soul, absolutely willing to talk at any time. She even texted me every once in a while and just said, hey, how are you doing? Are you doing okay? Eventually, our relationship grew so much that she was willing to come on the show. She became a fan of the Infinite Rabbit Hole, loved our episodes, constantly reached out about this and that after she listened to an episode, And it was awesome. It was absolutely phenomenal. Unfortunately, she passed away last year on May 19th. It's very, very sad. She fought for a very, very long time with multiple sclerosis. And she did a lot of really good work in the MS community. She was an active supporter of the MS Society and was very involved in that. Tanya was just an absolutely amazing person. I'm very, very thankful that I had the opportunity to talk to her. And it's thanks to her and Asher's that the Injured Cold series that we did a long time ago became so big. You can even say, I've grown intimate with the topic of Injured Cold. And now, whenever I read something, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it could be Bigfoot. It could be a haunting. It could be interdimensional, flat earth, hollow earth, anything. It's hard not to draw lines connected to the Injured Cold story in some way, shape, or form. I don't have much else to say. Once again, thank you very much, everybody, for taking the time to listen to the show. This is our 100,000 download, stream, play, whatever you want to call it, celebration episode, and was voted by you, the travelers of the Infinite Rabbit Hole. I can't say it enough. I can't. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be able to remaster this episode into this format for somebody who doesn't want to listen to all the chit-chat that the old series had. Anywho, I'm going to let you guys go now because now I'm rambling, and I just can't say it enough, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much. The Infinite Rabbit Hole has so much more ahead, including our very first live appearance in a festival this year. More news on that later. Once I cross my T's and dot my I's on that, I'll get back to you. But anyways, again, rambling. Until next time, travelers, I'll see you in the next fork, the path of the Infinite Rabbit Hole.
I would like to thank you once again for tuning in to the Infinite Rabbit Hole podcast. Please make sure to give us a follow and one of those beautiful 5-star ratings on your podcast player of choice. If you would like to join the conversation and stay up to date on all things Infinite Rabbit Hole, head on over to Facebook and search for the Infinite Rabbit Hole Facebook group. You'll know it's us when you see the logo. If you would like to help contribute to the cause, there are a few ways to do so. First, head on over to anchor.fm/infinite rabbit hole and click on the subscribe button, where for $5 a month you'll get access to all our old episodes that will never see the free spotlight ever again. It's horrible stuff, but if you're into that kind of thing, then go check it out. Second, head on over to infiniterabbithole.com and click on the IRH merch shop tab and grab yourself a sweet t-shirt, sticker, or whatever else you see that you wouldn't mind owning. Until next time, travelers, I'm Jeremy, and I'll see you at the next fork in the path of the Infinite Rabbit Hole. Bye. Imagine that this line represents the time, present 19.